my name is John Chung. Thank you for listening to Totally Awesome Films, where I discuss some of the greatest films ever made. Each week, I watch a movie, talk about what I thought of the movie, research a little bit about how it got made, and discuss why I think the film is totally awesome. In this podcast, we're going to talk about the 1983 Sean Connery film, Never Say Never Again. Now, obviously, 1983 was a great year for 007. The original Bond, the real Bond, was returning to theaters. And, you know, everyone had always told me that Sean Connery was a better Bond than Roger Moore, but I have to admit, I had difficulty watching some of those old Connery Bond films. So, you know, I can appreciate the films now as like an older film connoisseur. However, when you're a teenager, it's difficult to watch really old movies. I'm experiencing a little bit of that phenomenon now in my marriage, where my wife, who's about 9 years younger than me, and she's 35, but even she has difficulty watching like 80s movies. Now for me, 80s movies do not seem old, but to her, they seem about as old as like when I see a 70s movie. So it's kind of weird that she'll think of 80s movies as old movies. But so you can imagine how I feel when I see like a 70s movie or even a 60s film. You know, the colors seem a little grainy, there's lack of special effects, they use this cheesy back projector whenever someone's driving, and so it's hard to really get over that old movie feel. And of course, all the Sean Connery Bond films have that old movie film. So this movie was a chance to appreciate a Connery Bond in the modern era. Now, everyone was excited about this film back in 1983, and I have to admit, I really enjoyed it too. And like For Your Eyes Only and Octopussy, I can't tell you how many times I've seen this on cable TV. You know, I think I've seen all three of these movies over 100 times each. You know, they just aired it over and over again, and I saw it anytime I got a chance. So again, this is another movie that I have such fond memories, such nostalgia attached to this film, that for me, it's really impossible for me to disconnect myself from the nostalgia and see this movie objectively for what it is. And I have difficulty understanding why some critics don't like this movie. Now, one criticism that I can understand is that it is a direct remake of Thunderball. And in many ways, it's almost like a shot-by-shot remake. I mean, almost. I mean, there are significant differences, but you know, you get what I mean. And I generally tend to notice that those who don't like this movie are those that have seen Thunderball first and really fell in love with that film and just see this as a cheap knockoff. And I can understand that, because when I think of movies that I fell in love with as a kid and I see the movies that were remade, I just can't appreciate the remakes, even though the remakes are quite good. For example, I thought this recent Karate Kid remake with Jackie Chan and Will Smith's son, I thought that was pretty good. But for me, the real Karate Kid will always be the one with Ralph Macchio. And then there are the movies with really bad remakes, like The Longest Yard or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Clash of the Titans. And of course, now that they've announced that they're going to remake RoboCop, it's kind of starting to scare me. So I can understand that when adults say that, you know, those adults that fell in love with Thunderball have a difficulty with this film, I can understand that. So, you know, now remember, because Thunderball is still the number one James Bond film in terms of box office when adjusted for inflation. So it has a lot of fans. Now, for me, I was fortunate for this movie that I never saw Thunderball. And in fact, up until this movie, I had never even seen a Sean Connery Bond movie. So this is the movie that got me into Sean Connery as James Bond. It was this movie that got me to go rent Dr. No, and then got me to rent Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice. And the irony is, I actually didn't even see Thunderball until way after college. So I didn't even really appreciate that this movie was a remake until every aspect of this film had been ingrained in me as one of my favorite movies. So this movie has what I love about Bond movies. It has Sean Connery returning as James Bond. It has a beautiful, sexy, twisted femme fatale. It has an evil but very human villain in Maximilian Largo, and it has some great action sequences, an underwater shark scene, a motorcycle chase, but it has something else. This movie has video games, and then there's a scene where James Bond and Maximilian square off in a video game, and so, I mean, how can you not like that? So, how did this movie get made? Well, we know that in 1959, before Ian Fleming met Eon producers Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman to make Dr. No, he met a Hollywood producer named Kevin McClory. And Kevin McClory was a handsome war hero from World War II. And they wrote a screenplay together called 78 Longitude West. And this had James Bond facing off against a new villainous organization called Spectre. Well, this project fell apart, and Fleming took some of these ideas and turned them into his next novel, Thunderball, which he published in 1961. Well, Kevin McClory sued, and this trial went to court, and Kevin McClory won. The court said that Ian Fleming can keep the rights to Thunderball the book, but Kevin McClory would get the rights to Thunderball the movie and had to pay £50,000 in damages. And Kevin McClory got the rights to Spectre and Blofeld in all movie versions of James Bond. Now, in order to placate Kevin McClory, Eon Studios paid him a good deal of money, and they made Thunderball their fourth film. Now, I have a discussion about this on my Thunderball podcast. And, you know, they gave him executive producer title on the film, and they did this in exchange for the rights to Thunderball and Blofeld and Spectre for 10 years. Well, in 1975, Kevin McClory got his rights back, and he began production on his own competing James Bond film with the title called Warhead. Now, he really tried to get Richard Burton to play James Bond. He was trying to get Orson Welles to play Blofeld, and he was really trying to get Richard Attenborough to direct the film. So, I mean, that would have been something. That blows my mind. But, however, Eon was able to sue and delay production, and due to the delay in production, he was unable to secure any of these three actors, you know, Richard Burton, Orson Welles, and director Richard Attenborough. However, in 1981, Kevin McClory secured a huge coup when he was able to convince Sean Connery to return as James Bond. Now, by the end of his run as James Bond, Sean Connery's relationship with the producer, Cubby Broccoli, had deteriorated, and many think that this might have been a way for Sean Connery to see as a way to kind of stick it to the Eon producers. So the movie production began under the title James Bond of the Secret Service. Eon sued again, saying that it was too close to their previous film, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and the London court ruled in Eon's favor. However, it was Sean Connery's wife that suggested the title, Never Say Never Again, referring to Connery's statement that after Diamonds Are Forever, that he would never again play Bond. The producers loved it, and when you watch the credits, they actually acknowledge her in the credits by saying, quote, title Never Say Never Again by Michelin Connery. Another thing that helped get this movie made was Jack Schwartzman became interested in this movie. Jack Schwartzman is Talia Shire's husband, and Talia Shire is famous for playing Adrian in the Rocky series, as well as Connie in the Godfather series. She's also Francis Ford Coppola's sister. So once Jack Schwartzman got involved, the project began to get greenlit. In fact, toward the end of the movie, when the producers began to run out of money, Jack Schwartzman put up his own cash to finish the film. So you can see why it's important to have someone like that attached to the movie. For director, Kevin McClory was able to hire Irvin Kershner, who was smoking hot in 1983 after the 1980s hit The Empire Strikes Back. So let's talk about what's really good about this movie. And the best thing about this movie is Sean Connery himself. I mean, here he is confident, he's tough, he's cool. And unlike Roger Moore, we feel that it's really him, not some stuntman, doing the fight scenes. For those of us that were too young to have seen Sean Connery in the theaters, this is a very interesting way to be introduced to the man. In fact, I don't think that I would have gone as a teenager to rent Dr. No or Goldfinger if I had not seen this movie in the theaters. I think this movie also introduced a whole generation of people my age to Sean Connery. Because if you think about it, Sean Connery had not really done that well after leaving the James Bond franchise. He did a lot of artistic movies. You know, he was in small films like Outland, Robin and Marion, Zardoz. He had a part in Murder on the Orient Express. You know, I remember him in a small part as King Agamemnon in Time Bandits, even though he was the big top-billed star. He just had a little tiny, you know, piece in it. However, after Never Say Never Again, that's when he became the superstar that we think of when we think of Sean Connery. He starred in Highlander. He won an Oscar for his role in The Untouchables. He played Indiana Jones' father in The Last Crusade. He also had starring roles in Presidio, Medicine Man, Name of the Rose, Rising Sun, First Night, The Rock with Nicolas Cage. And, you know, really, if you think about it, he was arguably the biggest superstar of the 1990s. And therefore, it was quite a brilliant move to sort of spark it here with this movie. As James Bond, I think he nails the performance, and he is clearly the strongest thing in this movie. He's dashing, he's suave, he's tough. He is extremely confident, and unlike the last two movies that he was in, you sense that he is having a great time. Now, this is interesting because I had my wife see this today, in preparation for watching this podcast. We had seen the Daniel Craig James Bond movies in the theaters and loved them. And whereas I grew up in the Roger Moore era of James Bond, now she's 9 years younger than me, so she was a teenager when Pierce Brosnan was James Bond, so to her, that is her favorite James Bond. So she had never really seen a Sean Connery Bond, although, you know, she did know that he was Bond in the past. So what I had her do is I had her watch this, and I had her watch Dr. No, because I was interested in an objective take of Sean Connery as James Bond. So this is kind of an interesting scientific experiment for me. Young Connery Bond versus old Connery Bond. So this is cool because then I can find out a different opinion that wasn't clouded by my own nostalgia. And since I can't be objective, it was a chance for me to see what another objective adult thought. Well, what do you think she preferred? She loved the Connery of Never Say Never Again and was so lukewarm on the Connery of Dr. No. She thought this older Connery was much more attractive, thought that he was confident, whereas she said that she kind of thought that the James Bond of Dr. No was a little smarmy. So I thought that was interesting. Now she says she still likes Pierce Brosnan over all the other Bonds, including Daniel Craig and Roger Moore, but she conceded that this Sean Connery, the one in Never Say Never Again, most resembled who she imagined James Bond as a character actually being, even more than Pierce Brosnan. And I thought that was very interesting. Another great element of this film is Klaus Maria Brandauer as Maximilian Largo. He's wonderful in this film. He's clearly evil and clearly dangerous, but there's this very human vulnerability to him. I mean, he is just sort of a boy that just wants to be loved, but he's smart enough that he is capable of harming the world, and that makes him very dangerous. As an actor, that must be very difficult to play that balance between being evil but also being very likable and sympathetic. So I really think Klaus Brandauer pulls it off. McClory achieved another coup in hiring Max von Sydow as Blofeld. Sydow had already played Blofeld in From Russia with Love, and he is excellent here. And how he chooses to play Blofeld is he sort of underplays him as this sort of corporate executive, and I think it works. It gets the feeling that Spectre is this huge multinational business. In a minor casting bit, we have Rowan Atkinson, who was in his first major movie here. Prior to this film, he was a relative unknown. He had a few episodes of television, but after this film, he would go on to reach superstar status, of course, as Mr. Bean. He would have a recurring part on Blackadder, and then eventually play in the movie Johnny English, which is a parody of James Bond. And really, he became arguably one of the most iconic comedic characters of the modern era. We also have Pat Roach in this movie. He's a character that gets cuckolded when Bond is in the spa. Bond seduces his wife, and so this huge man decides to attack and beat up James Bond for revenge. And if you remember, he dies when Bond splashes his urine on his face, and he backs up into broken beakers that stab his back. Well, I did not recognize him at the time, but this is the same actor who played the bald Nazi who attacks Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, the one that gets killed by the propeller of the airplane. It turns out that he was also the bad guy in Temple of Doom and in The Last Crusade. And apparently also played Hephaestus in the original Clash of the Titans, you know, the god that ends up making the robotic owl Bupo. Again, since I love this movie as a child, it's difficult for me to watch it objectively as an adult and separate it from my childhood joy and nostalgia, because all I have is fun when I see this. However, I do remember seeing this in the theaters as a 14-year-old teenager, and I remember feeling a little disoriented by the absence of some of the Eon elements. So there's no opening gun barrel scene, There's no classic James Bond theme music. There's no pre-credit action teaser. And there's no sexy music montage. Now, watching this as an adult and within the context of this current sequential viewing where I'm watching all the James Bond movies in order, I did notice a few things that I hadn't realized before. So first of all, let me say this. So having researched the Bond franchise, and now I know how hard Kevin McClory worked to get this film made, well, it really begged the question, was Kevin McClory the real deal, you know, like an auteur, or was he just out for cash? In other words, was he an auteur who was the victim of Ian Fleming, or was he just a greedy con man wanting to make some quick cash off this unusual opportunity? Well, this movie is basically our chance to find out. I mean, this is his vision of 007. This is his chance to prove that he is an artist. You know, he's got Connery, he's got the right suspector, he's got this huge budget, and this is his chance to show us his artistic vision of 007 and basically create new James Bond elements, sort of rewrite the language that we think of as James Bond. And when we think of it in this way, as much as I love the movie, it's pretty obvious that Kevin McClory was just doing a cash grab, you know, and just trying to hitch himself to Ian Fleming and Eon's wagon. So here is why I think so. So first, we have the theme song, Never Say Never Again. I mean, this song is really, really bad. And not only is it bad and it sounds like it's sung off key, it is an earworm and it just sticks in your ear for a couple of days. You know, now this song was originally written for Bonnie Tyler, you know, of Total Eclipse of the Heart and Holding Out for a Hero. And she was very honored to be asked to do a Bond theme song. However, she disliked this song so much that as much as she wanted to do a Bond song and be in the movie, she had to refuse to do it. That's how bad this song was. It eventually was sung by a singer named Lonnie Hall, who I actually think is a better singer than she seems to do here. Likewise, instead of the gun barrel scene, we get this opening overlapping 007, 007, 007 montage, which really is kind of stupid. I mean, here again, here's a chance for McClory to sort of rewrite the language, and it seems like he doesn't even bother. So now that I know that this is a copy of Thunderball, as much as I enjoyed the movie, I do think that an artistic opportunity was lost. So it's apparent to me now that Kevin McClory wasn't really trying to give us a new artistic vision of Bond. He was just trying his damn best to make you think this was an Eon production. There's really nothing new. And it's simply obvious to me that Kevin McClory knew he had leached himself onto a huge cash cow and was just trying his hardest to suck a little milk out of it. So, you know, his way of just making a quick buck. Now, at the end of the movie, Bond tells Nigel, the Rowan Atkinson character, that he will never again work for MI6. And then we have a woman say, "Darling, never say never again." And Bond looks at the camera and winks. And this is only the second time in the Bond series that Bond directly breaks the fourth wall. The last was Lazenby when he said, you know, "This never happened to the other fella." However, it is rumored that Sean Connery had another ending in mind. Connery wanted the ending where he's walking down the street and he tells Nigel, "Never." And then he bumps into another man. And when Bond looks at who he is, he would do a double take, and the camera would pan to the other gentleman, and it would be none other than Roger Moore, who would say, "Never say never again." And here's the amazing thing about that, is that Roger Moore and Sean Connery were good friends. They kept in regular contact with each other, so Roger Moore agreed to do it. However, the director and the producers were unwilling, because they thought it would be ridiculous, so, you know, kind of become a joke, and They didn't do it. And I don't know. I'm really debating in my head whether it would have been a good idea or not. So I'm interested in what you think. Post your comments whether you think it would have been a good idea or not. The film opened to $9.7 million, higher than Octopussy's $8.9 million, and it would go on to gross a total of $160 million. However, Octopussy, which came out 8 weeks earlier, would go on to gross over $187 million, making it the leader. Now, you know, we say that Octopussy won the battle, but it's very important to keep in mind that both movies did very well. This movie was a box office success. So much so that Kevin McClory decided that he was going to do another sequel, Eon sued, and they were fighting in courts for the rights to do the sequel. And rumor is that Kevin McClory was actually winning. By the year 2000, he was actually trying to make another movie, a semi-sequel, semi-remake of this film called Warhead 2000, and you know, Sean Connery didn't want to do it anymore. He was actually going to have Timothy Dalton star in this movie. However, on December 4th, 1997, MGM purchased the rights to Never Say Never Again. That's right, MGM, the owners of the Eon franchise, bought this film. And this is why Never Say Never Again is now included in the James Bond DVD collections. And then in 2006, Kevin McClory passed away. So now that Eon owns Never Say Never Again, recently there was talk of redoing some of the music and the montage scenes to make it fit more into the James Bond canon. So can you imagine this movie starting off with the gun barrel sequence and then having the classic James Bond theme music in it? Well, the producer decided not to do it, but if they had, I don't know. I personally would have been in favor of it. But what do you think? I'd like to hear your opinions. Just post them on the comment section on the Facebook page. So, report card? Well, it's good to see Sean Connery back in action. And for some of us, it was the first time seeing him in action. And despite this film being an obvious cash grab, even when I see it now, all I see is the fun that I had while watching this in the theaters as a teenager. So that's all for this podcast. If you like this podcast, please like our Facebook page, Totally Awesome Films. And also, please subscribe to Totally Awesome Films on iTunes. It's totally free, and you can download it and listen to it in your car. And if you have time, please leave us a 5-star rating, because that helps us show up on search engines. Please join us next time for a discussion of Roger Moore's last outing as James Bond 007 in A View to a Kill.